Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I'm not a man, I'm a machine. Chisel me down until I am clean. I buy books I never read, and then I'll tell you some more about me. Beneath the concrete there's a sound, a muffled cry below the ground. There is a poison in the air, a mix of chemicals and fear.
Paul, how are you, buddy?
Yeah, I'm doing very, very well. Very well indeed. I'm just going to get my recorders all set up and ready to go. I have to make sure I do those at the start. Go again.
Hello.
There we are. Lovely stuff. I bought this thing called the Rodecaster Pro, right, which is like a kind of home radio desk that allows you to do high quality phoners. And I've been doing that for the last, six, however long we've been in this thing. Well, I guess a year.
Yeah.
And I switched to Zoom this year because I was like, if it's going to still be going on just for my own sake of sanity and mixing it up, I've switched to Zoom. And so far, so good. I imagine you've been doing a lot of these, and this is the first time you've ever done all digital press campaigns.
Yes, it is.
How has it been for you with the removal of the human element?
It's been okay. It's difficult because I feel like more people, people get more from that sort of personal interaction and being in the same room and all that kind of stuff. But on the other hand, obviously I don't have to go very far. I just go up to my attic room where I'm talking to you from now. And in some ways it's a little bit easier. I associate all the interviews with being out on the road and doing like an in-store or doing a gig, wherever it might be in Germany or in this country. So yeah, it feels wrong because I know that, yeah, the sort of shackles are on in some way, and that's fair enough. Everybody's got so many things that they've got to deal with. I feel doing things this way is okay, compared to what some people have to do.
Yeah, I wonder how much of this world will remain when the old world returns, because I've got so many friends who I imagine the companies they work for, their businesses, will continue to operate from home. They're going to, go, well, why would we waste all this money on renting out office spaces when everybody can function just as highly from their homes? I think it's going to change the world. Hopefully not too much, but when we do revert back to some form of, normality, the effects of this thing on every level, like psychologically, economically, sociologically, it's going to linger for, if not forever, for a long time, isn't it?
Yeah,
both the good and the bad.
That's right. There's going to need to be some sort of reconfiguration, and people can kind of see the world slightly differently. And, we realize that if you need an economic stimulus for people who are really struggling, you probably can create one from this sixth richest country in the world. People couldn't see a time when carbon emissions would go down, and yet obviously with people not getting in the cars as much and people not flying as much, those kind of things, you know, you see an immediate effect. So you know that it can be done, but obviously that's not the way that our world works, and that we've built up an industrialized world where we rely on certain things that do have carbon emissions to go from A to B and to make things work. So yeah, it in an ideal world, which we clearly don't live in, you know, you would find a sort of a happy medium where we could really make an impact on things like poverty and on, you know, reducing emissions. But my prevailing instinct is that yes, people just want to get back to normal, whatever that means. And, you know, people have made sacrifices for the last year and will continue to do so for most of this year. And I think that makes people feel like, okay, we've done our bit. Let's get back to normal. But there's a bigger picture as well that I hope, you know, governments who can have more control over it than I do, can look at that. But you know, again, I don't have too much faith that that'll happen, because, you know, it's economically driven and it's all about thriving in that kind of capitalist sense. So yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I want to go off on a slightly different tangent in a minute, but for me, capitalism really is the worst thing in the world. I know that there's many other things that plague our society. There's obviously racism still, you know, very much in full effect, as we've seen, particularly this year, and, you know, sexism as well. And, you know, the mistreatment of so many people in the entertainment industry we've seen in the last couple of years as well. But for me, the far greater evil than all of that, and the root really of all of it, which is greed, and driven by, not to go off on too much of a negative rant at the start, but it's just such an awful model, isn't it? The big C, capitalism.
Well, I mean, it's you know, we need to restructure our society, and to what extent that is done is the big question for people on the so-called left. You know, how do you do that? What lengths do you go to? You know, for musicians, and you know, that's obviously my personal world, and you think of the things that give music out to people, you know, the so-called service, you know, platforms or providers, you know, there's a lot of kind of corporate language involved in music industry kind of things, because it's an industry and it is corporate. And I come from a sort of outside perspective on that, and from a more DIY background, and you know, I see the way that it can, you know, I see the way that things turn out for the people who are making the music, and it doesn't seem fair. But then, what is fair is a big question, and how do you go about making that happen? You know, do you withdraw your music from one of the big platforms because you don't believe in how they remunerate artists? Do you, you know, what not work with big companies? Or do you then look at it and go, well, which big company isn't, you know, great at, you know, who are there any that are great at workers' rights? And across the board, you realize that the structure that you're in has loads and loads of flaws. But do you withdraw from it, or do you try and fight for change within? Is that futile? I mean, the questions are kind of endless on this, and it can scramble your brain. But I think you do have to be aware of those things. Otherwise, you're not thinking about what you're doing. You're not thinking about others as well, because there's, you know, impacts on everybody from our own small behaviors and a kind of ripple effect that goes out from there. And obviously people who have more power in whatever industry it might be really have the controls to change things. And yes, I think a lot of the change in that sort of Marxist way, you know, it needs to come from the masses and from people who are working. But I think one of the problems, if you can call it that, is that we're quite comfortable, the majority of us, and we don't see the sort of, you know, the people who are in poverty, and we don't see the people at the top, you know, however, whatever tiny percentage that owns the majority of a country's wealth. Those, you know, everybody else is struggling to a lesser or greater extent, but you know, you might still have your subscription to whatever that you can watch on a night. You know, all these things, it's all kind of interlinked, and you know, it feels like that we, you know, society could be much better structured. I'm not saying that I know the right way to do it, and I also think one of the problems that our society in Britain, the West, whatever you want to call it, is that we, you know, we're sort of blinded by power and celebrity, and you know, our politicians, it's a, you know, personality politics is part of the reason why we have Boris Johnson in charge of our country. You know, looking at his track record and his, you know, his pronouncements over the years and his shady journalistic actions, which are all on record, you know, it's all there for people to see. None of that really matters when it comes to the crunch, because the media perception of him is bumbling, but from an affluent background, an educated background, he's got the right accent to succeed in our country, and all of those different things, it just all tots up to create this figurehead that people need, you know, the so-called strong man, you know, that you can see from Hungary to the US over the last 4 years anyway, until the recent transition, again, arguable as to what the degree of change is, you know, all very interesting questions. But it does boil down to this idea that people take notice of what somebody says if they're on the, you know, on the TV, if they have a platform, if they're being interviewed for a podcast. You know, what do I know? I'm a musician. But I mean, on the other hand, people do look to artists and to people that they, you know, they respect in order to sort of make sense of the world. And it's almost like a little collaboration or a kind of conversation that goes on. And I think that means that people who are in those positions have a responsibility not to, you know, spout loads of anti-vax theories, which are, again, a few pop stars or rock stars have been going down that road. And yeah, to me, society could be a lot more balanced in every respect, whether it's, you know, not paying any attention to what I'm saying, or, you know, trying to solve child poverty or whatever. It's all interlinked, I suppose.
Have you seen the new Adam Curtis documentary series?
I haven't. It's on my list of things to watch. But yeah, with our album coming out, I'm not sure I needed an extra lump of stuff to think about at the moment.
Yeah, because his stuff is heady, and he really does draw these links and these parallels, and it's kind of everything you're alluding to there. There's so much going on, and it is all intertwined, and I think such a big part of it is technology. And so I love the way you're obviously trying to like reclaim and reconnect with the natural world. I presume that's, you know, part of what you're doing with the new album. And for me, this year, such a huge part of my mental health and self-preservation and trying to stay optimistic and connected, and almost by being disconnected from this fucking maelstrom of noise and chaos in the news and social media and everywhere online, and actually just pull it back to the natural world and go on daily walks and connect with nature. And that's been so enriching for my soul. I wonder whether that has been, you know, a somewhat similar journey you've been on with the lyrics and the themes of this album. Is that, you know, the natural world, the old world, perhaps a more simplistic way of life, a part of where you're coming from with this record?
Well, I mean, it kind of boils down to one song in terms of that area, where the Child of the Flatlands song that closes the record touches on those issues. And it's also where we got the album title from, Nature Always Wins. And I kind of used that as a bit of a starting off point for perhaps what the themes on the record might be, because a lot of it is to do with parenthood. My daughter's nearly five now, so that the whole last 4 years of writing this record or thinking about new music since our last record involved lots of thoughts about her and how her existence impacts on me and how mine impacts on her. And
is it your first child, Paul?
It is. It is. Yeah. First so and last.
it's a complete reconfiguration of your relationship with the world, isn't it?
It is. And that's why it comes down to things like, you know, big questions like, what are we doing to the world? And what is my relationship with the bigger picture? What can I control? Which are kind of themes that, you know, Maxine Moore Park songs have touched upon over the years anyway. Yeah. You know, something like Waves of Fear from our fourth record was about that topic and trying to see if you could control what's in your sort of direct line of sight, and hopefully that would be a good starting point instead of being overwhelmed by the bigger picture. You know, those kind of things have been part of the fabric of the songs, but I think the new album is a little bit more reflective. And you know, that song that I mentioned, Child of the Flatlands, was looking back at my childhood and thinking, you know, childhood is a simpler time, hopefully, you know, for most kids out there. And you know, even in kind of the playground sense, you know, what's right and what's wrong seems to be very basic. And even if you're on the wrong side of that, and I, you know, I went back to my old town of Billingham to make some photographs and sketches for some paintings that I wanted to do, which is a kind of ongoing thing that I'll hopefully get around to doing at some point when I've stopped homeschooling.
Have you been doing the single album cover art work?
I have not. No. No.
But they're great, they are.
Yeah, thank you. That's our friend Laura Lancaster, who I went to art college with in Hartlepool, and we've known each other. We were in a band together. We formed a band at art college, even though we didn't call it that. We were just practicing in each other's bedrooms. And myself and Laura's sister Rachel, who's also a really talented artist, the Lancaster twins, they've been part of my life for so long now that I wasn't quite sure whether Laura would allow us to use that, because she's quite acclaimed really in the art world. I think she's got an exhibition at the moment in South Korea, and
oh wow,
yeah, she's you know, well known. Her works in books, and is very expensive. And so yeah, I thought she might not let us use it, but I think she realized that the sort of the distorted childhood images and family life that she gets from old slides that she finds and old family photos that she gets from flea markets and then, you know, works her magic on, they sort of mirrored what I wanted to talk about on the record, because family life is such an intense experience, even though it's in some senses it's seen as you know, domestic life is seen as kind of very boring and, you know, not natural subject matter for a pop song. And, you know, I love pop songs, and I love elevating everyday life into pop songs and trying to see if I can make it not just interesting but universally connective to people. And so yeah, that tied in again to that particular song of Child of the Flatlands, and a few of the other ones that talk about that, the ups and downs and the highs and lows of parenthood, which are the highs and lows of love, you know, and trying to do the right thing. And again, that extends to nature always wins, you know, our human nature tends to win out. And you can obviously make it into something very relevant by thinking about the pandemic and how, you know, humans are trying to deal with that and are doing a pretty good job, all things considered, in terms of the science. But ultimately, we've been humbled by nature, just by the things around us and the natural world and our environment. And we will be eventually, over a very slow, long process of time, we'll be humbled again when the weather and the heat rises and all sorts of different things are linked to that. You know, a lot of people will move away from warmer areas of the earth that'll eventually erode farming land, and everybody will be whinging about migrants again. And you think, this is, you know, all of these things are inevitable because of the way that we treat the world and the way that we treat each other. We need to have empathy and try and look at solving things together. You know, even down to the vaccine in our country, once we're vaccinated, are we going to just close the borders and stop those 12,000 people coming in every day, using the airports, which is obviously a very small number compared to what it usually would be. But it's still, this is a global issue and we need to work together. And, again, that goes back to the song Child of the Flatlands, where after this first part of the song, which is kind of longing for a simpler life, walking by riverbanks and in the places of town where industry meets nature and nature takes over these old factories and reclaims what was once its own. In those places, we kind of move on in the song to talk of a borderless world, and the old world is clinging to the coattails. And there's so many ideas about the West. There's so many ideas about our own country, the sort of empirical thinking and the exceptionalism of ourselves. And somewhere like America's the USA is quite a good example again of the exceptionalism. America's the greatest country on earth, and we need, we look after everything globally as well as on our own doorstep. And we need to look at the reality of that situation again, the disconnect between reality and what is perceived is part of, it's part of the songs. I'm trying to work it out myself. And on the song, I Don't Know What I'm Doing, one of the kind of punkier songs on the record, that is the question. It says, when I work it all out, I'll tell you, I know, I don't know what I'm doing. And whilst that was me addressing my daughter, I think, anybody, whether they're a parent or not, has those feelings of self-doubt, and we all want to know more about the world, and we all think we're important, and we are, but we're also part of this bigger picture that goes back to again what we've been talking about.
Wow. I mean, there's so many things I want to try and get into off the back of that. Let me try and go through them all in my head. So the first thing for me, I was having a chat with a friend of mine the other day, and he was sort of talking to me about how it's almost this innate human philosophy and approach to life that we don't respond to a threat until it's right there in front of us. So climate change being a good example of something that we've known about for so many years, but until it's right there and, the sea levels are rising and, places like Texas at the moment, there's water freezing, it's so cold. Until it's on your doorstep, I think people are so slow to react, aren't they? And that's not just the politicians, that's like us, regular people like me and you, because you don't want to go through your whole life living in this survivalistic mode of fear and constant high alert. But I think this last year, as you say the word there, humbled, this last 12-month pandemic experience all over the globe, I think, has really leveled the playing field and hopefully taught us all that we need to be a little bit more self-aware of not just our immediate surroundings, but of the larger picture, i.e. the planet that we're all here living on, and doing away with borders and working together to try and actually preserve the world for kids like yours and their kids and so on.
Well, I mean, that go on that sort of on the micro level of zooming in again to the record that we've just made, that idea of what have I passed on to my daughter in terms of behavior, and everything really, but in terms of behavior, and whether my own behavior is the cause of her behavior, whether my DNA is part of it, and I can't really do anything about that, and just wondering exactly what the ramifications of your own behavior are, that's kind of something that all of us can think about. And you can think about, I've said it recently, you go to the supermarket and somebody's been working there all day long and they're having a bad one, and you can control how your interaction with this person goes, even though it's a very, it's a transactional thing. We can be empathetic. We can talk to other people. If somebody doesn't want to talk, we can try and know when to draw back. And I think that's one of the other questions on the record, is how does our behavior impact other people, and can we modify it, or are we doomed to repeat ourselves? Are we so limited as human beings in the wider picture, which you were talking about just there? Are we Are we stuck in this kind of groove that just, you know, we'll be enlightened and then everything will relax again? And you could look at that, you could look at our own country again on the on that sort of less global and more of a national level, where we've gone into these lockdowns and then eased up, and we've gone back into the another lockdown and a worse one as well, you know, a worse effect. And then, you know, is that something that we're dooming ourselves to now? Because we're, you know, I was speaking to a friend of mine who's a teacher, and he can't believe that we're sending 10, you know, whatever it is, you know, 10 million kids back to school. I don't know what it is. But like
a lot of kids.
Yeah. A hell of a lot of kids. You know, why couldn't they have waited 3 weeks till the Easter half term and just put primary school kids and kids who are doing exams back in at secondary school? And, you know, the answers are obviously, you know, that are open to debate. And I'm not saying that I know the answer to this, but there is a prevailing thought that is bandied about in the media. And I look at all the newspaper headlines most days just to see what the broad spectrum is, you know, what, comparing all of them to each other, what is the truth between all of the different standpoints. And you know, as a left-leaning person, I will obviously have my own biases, no doubt about that. But I think, you know, it's, you know, we are obsessed with what's right in front of our nose. And yes, as you say, until something gets forced into our blinkered vision, you know, it doesn't really impact on our thinking, or we can put it aside. And I mean, you know, that's the way we are as individuals. But to go back to our initial sort of more societal way of thinking, it has to be connected to power and economic priorities. The reason why climate change hasn't been dealt with is because of powerful interests in the industries that profit from you know, burning fossil fuels. And that is, you know, the people who are in charge of some of those multinational companies have been proven to have employed many people at their own personal cost to, you know, provide disinformation. And I think that's one of the key aspects of the world that we are emerging into, is the idea of disinformation and technology being our sort of main means of communicating with each other, you know, whereas that might not have been the case. It might have been more community-based. National media was more limited to, you know, a sort of key number of outlets. And so we end up with this situation where we have so much more data, and that is now being kind of bent to whatever it, you know, you want it to be applied to, which again is another one that scrambles your mind when you think about it like that. But you know, I can't blame anybody who doesn't really have climate change in their sort of, you know, as one of their priorities in life. You know, life is hard for a lot of people, and when you're working and trying to bring up kids, it's, you know, your priorities are very close to you, no doubt about it. And therefore we have to look at who we elect democratically and try and make sure that their priorities, while we can't keep our eye on that ball, you know, their priorities are to deal with these big issues whilst obviously looking after the people who voted them in. And I think, you know, if there is all of this kind of disinformation out there, it, you know, it's going to take a lot to try and convince people who haven't looked into it, who haven't got that sort of breadth of sources to look at. You know, they're looking at a Facebook or a YouTube video that's been posted by somebody who's, you know, a liar, you know, and then the algorithm will take them towards more people of that ilk, which again is a disturbing thing, you know, in terms of how much power the, you know, social media platforms have, and whether they know it or not. And that's, again, that's open to conjecture, obviously.
I wonder how much your daughter's generation, when she's old enough to be, you know, aware and wanting, if it's still a thing, to use things like Facebook or whatever the social media of the day will be. Because, as you say, there was a time when we were growing up, you're a few years older than me, but basically the same generation, where news was the newspapers, radio, television. That was it. And generally, although there was obviously, you know, subjectivity and bias involved with a lot of journalism, and, you know, each party, you know, perhaps funded particular papers and whatever, but there was always a sense of, well, this has gone through an editor and, you know, this platform, so it's fairly trustworthy. Now, with the internet, you can, anybody can write or say anything, post it, and then a lot of, what blows my mind is how many people now just assume that whatever they read or see or hear on the internet is true and is fact. And then the flip side to that, what also blows my mind is, and maybe this is just incredibly naive of me, well, of course it is, but, and I'm sure you're the same, like, I don't lie. I don't understand the value or what's to gain. How hopelessly ironic and naive is that? But for me, I want to live a truthful life. I want to be an authentic human being. So the idea of making stuff up is, that's like child's play. That's like playing a game in the woods with your friends. It seems so removed from the way I'd want to conduct myself in day-to-day life. And so you've got these people out there that are so willing to lie, and that's obviously the people right at the top of the tree as well, politicians all the way down to just, you know, internet celebrities. All these people want to spread misinformation, disinformation, lies, and then so many people are willing to accept it as truth. That, all of that together, is what makes me want to run away from technology for forever.
Absolutely.
And just live out, you know, in a nice community that has a corner shop and where the values are more deep rooted in, you know, the old fashioned way of life, the simpler way of life, going back to what I was saying earlier.
Well, I mean, it's a difficult one because, you know, there's obviously an argument that there's an inherent conservatism to that, the former orthodoxy of, you know, limited media outlets and, you know, even something like the BBC, which I'm a big supporter of, you know, obviously has, you know, editorial policies across the political departments, which I don't necessarily agree with, especially when you look at the background of people who are in those positions. But yeah, obviously, at the same time, everybody has an opinion, you know, everybody does have a bias and has their opinion on what the world should be like. And it would be almost impossible to mitigate against that. But I think you do need some sort of arbiters of truth. And I don't know where that comes from, whether it comes from the courts. Again, if you look at the percentage of high court judges and their background and, you know, what sex they are, what age they are.
Or more importantly, what class they're from,
well,
right? That seems to be the key.
Well, yeah. I mean, this is the thing. A lot of them are privately educated and part of a network. You know, we all have our own networks. You know, there's a network in the music industry. You know, that you can, there's different ones going, you know, going about it, more sort of independent networks, which are definitely important. There's more corporate networks, and again, those are the networks where, you know, you eventually find yourself earning a lot of money or being around a lot of money, which makes the world go around, as we know. And I think it's important, again, to have press standards. Who is appointed as the person in charge of all that? Again, how that gets into our current dilemmas with the Conservative government appointing whoever as the director of the BBC and Ofcom, who's going to be in charge of that. It all feeds back into that network of mostly privately educated older white men, and it doesn't represent our country. And I think,
yeah, not at all.
Yeah, I think that's always going to be a big issue. If you have representative bodies that can look at standards in whatever aspect of life, then I think you know you're getting more towards a fairer society, which is always going to be elusive, I'm afraid, because the you know the system that we live in is ingrained, and most of us profit from it, you know, in terms, you know, literally a percentage, a majority percentage of us are in some way comfortable with a roof over our heads, whether you're renting or you own your own house. And I think the other side of the coin is that yeah, all of that information out there, some of it is clearly useful and would never have been there before, you know, people going out on their own to deal with specific issues that might not be covered in a national newspaper or a local newspaper. Again, local newspapers, local radio stations are being edged out. Libraries, yeah. You know, sources of knowledge for working class people, or just places where you don't have to spend any money in the middle of a town or a city. You know, those places are important to me, you know, as a kind of sing about on the record. And I think it's very difficult to know how you could stop disinformation on the internet when, again, there are people being paid somewhere, wherever it might be, in St. Petersburg. I don't know. I've just read a book called This Is Not Propaganda by Peter Pomerantsev, which won the Gordon Byrne Prize last year. And it's all about those kind of the sort of war on truth and the people who are trying to fight back against it, and the language that's used in sort of disinformation and so-called fake news, and
yeah.
how objectivity is seen as a stance. You know, it's not really, it isn't objectivity, isn't there is no objectivity. and it, you know, if you're pretending, if you're acting like you're objective, then it is just an act, as far as, you know, Fox News is concerned, or whatever. And I think I can't really tell you what any of the answers are, but I feel like the way things were in terms of the limited amount of media was had pros and cons. And I think that it's the same with the internet and online discourse. It obviously one thing leads to another on search engines, and you know how who's paying for that, you know, who's advertising, and where do those search results lead you? And I'm not saying that it's even disinformation, it's just advertising, really. You know, it's people getting you to go down a certain path. That is something that needs addressing. You know, that there needs to be some sort of transparency in terms of how Google works or whatever. And the more control that these sort of four or five multinational social media and these different platforms have, it's only going to get worse, because it just becomes ingrained so much. You know, you don't have any chance to kind of instill some sort of industry standards on that the further down the line it goes.
And the key, really simply, is just critical thinking, isn't it? The ownership's on the individual, and that's something I've been thinking a lot about in this last year, is looking at how individuals react to this very specific situation we've been in, and just thinking, well, okay, this person's saying this thing, but then why are they saying that? And what you mentioned earlier, comparing and contrasting different sources, trying to get the broader picture. And then really just it's up to you as an individual to make up your own mind based on the information in front of you. Obviously, it's going to be led by your preordained biases and, you know, personal experiences to some extent. But if you can just try and absorb as much of a cross-section of information as possible, then you can make up your own mind, and then hope. I just would like more critical thinking in a nutshell, Paul.
Yeah.
And no, it's so refreshing reasonable. To talk to someone like yourself who is clearly of that exact same school of thought.
It's reasonable, you know. I'm an emotionally driven person, you know. I if you show me a graph and kind of explain it to me, then I'll listen, and I'll digest it, you know. I'll try and it might change my mind. You know, I think you've got to be open to having your mind changed. And
yep.
That is difficult for everybody. You know, I'm the same. You know, I have my beliefs, and I've worked at them over the course of whatever, 40 years. And but I believe that there's still room for me to learn more about the world, and for me to kind of adjust the way that I think about certain issues that I haven't even considered, you know, that people might bring to your attention. And it's up to you to again be humble and say, look, I don't know, you know, I don't know the answers to this. Can you help educate me? And then I can try and adjust my thinking and adjust my behavior to that. And I think that would be it's an ideal situation if you can be like that. And it's a battle to be like that. You know, our brains are wired the way that they have been since birth and since childhood, and the way that we've been shaped by the society that we live in. But you know, even, you know, you could take any sort of hot topic, you know, and say, let's have a look at the truth of the situation, you know, like immigration in our country. You know, you'll often hear people talking about people coming and stealing our jobs, or you'll hear about, you know, ethnic minority gangs of people preying upon young women. And if you look at the figures, you know, in neither case it's true that these things are happening. It's actually, again, it reflects society. You know, you'll find out that it's mostly white male grooming gangs or whatever, and you'll find out that you know, the people who are coming here to work are doing the jobs that we don't necessarily want to do. And you know, when it comes to fruit picking season, or you know, people working in care homes, you know, you'll find a shortage, or an NHS workers, you'll find a shortage of people in that area, especially due to the kind of hostile environment that has lowered immigration over the last year or two, and especially since the Brexit vote really made that such a toxic issue. And you know, I can't go around telling everybody, and I also think that if I did, people would say, who's this guy? You know, he's a daft pop star, you know. whatever, you know, you if I think that, and if I write about that, and if I talk about it, then it's, you know, that I would like to think that way of thinking permeates out a little bit, and again, people can go away and go, is that true? I don't necessarily believe it. And then they can find the information that I'm talking about, that, you know, I can't bring to mind, but somebody can then go and have a look at a, you know, a Financial Times graph on, you know, the pandemic, and see exactly what's going on and how things rise and fall with lockdowns. And and again, they can form their own opinion about that issue. I think the problem is that it there's so many bad actors in this, you know, bad faith actors, whatever you want to call it. People out there who are kind of asking very tenuous questions, you know, and using very ambiguous language so that they can't actually be censured for saying what they say, but it points people in a certain direction. And, you know, whether that's UKIP and Nigel Farage and the way that they've talked about immigrants, and then just fall short of saying something truly inflammatory, just something that's mildly inflammatory instead, then, you know, until that sort of thing can be combated in a way, you know, again, free speech means that they can kind of say what they want, but do we have to give them platforms? You know, again, that's something what, you know, academics have been talking about that recently, and what can be said in universities, and, you know, so-called cancel culture, which usually involves loads of people saying, I can't believe I've been cancelled on Newsnight or something like that. You know, some slightly ridiculous when you consider the, you know, the mouthpiece that these people have been given on a national or international level. So yeah, I'm starting to ramble now.
No, not at all, mate. Well, listen, let me tell you this. So last night I was watching the Found on Film tour documentary.
Oh, yeah.
which you guys shot back in the day. It made me so nostalgic for the noughties, shot beautifully on Super 8. But this is what was really strange about the whole experience. After your Found on Film tour documentary, there was an amazing documentary on The Clash in this random, you know, playlist, the algorithm playlist that YouTube threw up. So I started watching The Clash documentary afterwards and was like, oh, I wouldn't have picked this to follow this, but in the middle of those two things was a fucking advert, and it was Nigel Farage he was going on about how he'd gone up against the establishment and gone up against this, and it was like a cheap telesales. You know when you're watching like Channel 4 at about 4, you know the one I mean? And he's advertising some form of like, you know, financial investment thing.
That's right. That actually came on. We did a premiere of our last, we're doing kind of YouTube premieres where we'll go online and chat to people when a new video comes out. And it came on just after our video, and I thought, hang on a minute, this is kind of antithetical to what's going on here, but that is the way that it is, that, you know, that you can't control it. And I think it was weird because it kind of goes a little bit against what I've been saying, where you know, one thing leads to another and you end up having loads and loads of the same opinions. And you would have thought after one of our songs, you might get something good.
Well, you know, but music. Just before a Clash documentary as well. Do you know what I mean? Like you guys, yeah, fair enough. But then, you know, your tour diary is followed by a history of the Clash, one of the most notoriously, you know, right on bands of all time. And then in the middle of that is this guy. They must have just pumped so much money into it that it's just popping up everywhere. But I just thought, how ironic and hilarious and unsettling is it that this guy is just popped up here.
Yeah, I didn't wait very long to find out what it was. I almost smashed my screen.
Well, watching that documentary did take me back, and it made me realize, you know, because I'm not really somebody who looks back very much. I'm always in the moment. I don't really worry about the future or look back on, you know, the past either. I try and just live in the now as much as possible. I get sentimental when I see things that remind me of the past and stuff. But watching that documentary, I was like, fuck, the noughties were actually now like a whole generation ago. And it's almost like I just woke up one day and, you know, your first album had come out, what, 15 years ago now? And you think, where? And, you know, obviously now you're a dad. I mean, do you have those moments where you think, my God, where did life go?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, I'm rather like yourself, you know, I try and live in the present as much as possible. And, you know, if I look back at even a few years ago, I start to feel embarrassed. You know, I don't see myself in it, even though I kind of see myself in the music that we've made. You know, I feel very close to most of the songs on our records when I hear them, and they instantly transport me back to the moment where I was writing them. You know, not that necessarily the room or whatever, but just that I try and create a picture for people to sort of listen to, if that makes sense. You know, I try and write something that is kind of timeless in its way, but still very specific. And so when I sing the songs live, I feel in that moment, and I sort of bring it up. I'm like a strange clairvoyant for my past, and meet those personalities or those people again, and bring them into the room and try and you know, express what the song is about. So, you know, I definitely understand how you can be transported, but I also think life is to me very sequential. I feel, you know, I don't feel like there are sort of large periods of my life in where I don't remember what happened. And then,
yeah, that makes sense. One thing leads to another,
you know, and then, so I see it all very much as a trajectory. And so I feel very close to the first record and us at that time, because I still feel a lot of those feelings. I'm still the same person who has the same, probably the same hang-ups, the same obsessions, the same enjoyments. And yet I'm different and I have changed and my life has changed. I mean, I think there's on the new album, there's something that kind of discusses that in the song, I Don't Know What I'm Doing. It says, my tastes are still the same. It's just my habits that have changed. The nightly ritual is new, but feels as old as time. And, you know, to me, that's how I feel.
That's life.
You know, I feel like I'm part of something that is bigger than myself. And yet, I have my own little rituals. I have, and those have changed. You know, I don't go out like I used to go out on a night. I'm in and I'm perfectly happy with that, you know. And I mean, I'm still, when gigs are going on, I'm still out maybe two or three times a week at a gig, because music is my life. You know, I go and watch bands on our night off on tour, and the rest of our crew just look at me like I'm mad. you know, they just want a break from the noise and from being in a kind of dingy, sweaty venue. But I just, I'm always looking at it as a kind of fan, really. And so when I look at even our own music, and it sounds odd to say it perhaps, but you know, I'm our biggest supporter. I'm a kind of zealot who goes around saying, check this out, it's really good, and this is what it's about. And when I sing the songs, that's kind of what I'm saying, and that's why I perform in the way that I do. I want to draw people in. I don't mind looking slightly ludicrous doing it. You know, I want to put on a show for people and make their lives better for like whatever it is, an hour and a half of a gig, or 40 minutes of a record, or 3 minutes if a song comes on the radio. And so for me, when I look at things like Found on Film, or see some sort of footage of us, you know, I'm slightly embarrassed because of the way that I look or whatever, but I feel like a kind of a pride, and I think that person's trying to do the right thing. And if I can keep that up through my life and through the music that we make, then that's kind of all I can ask, really. I can't control what other people think of our music. I can't control what other people think of me too much if they don't really know me. But I can obviously control how I do the things that I do. I can control my own personal interactions with people and try and do as well as I can in that respect, and treat people well around me, and show empathy, and be engaged with the world around me. And I think that when I look at my past, at a certain point, I feel like that's something that we kind of laid out as a band. That's the kind of band we were going to be. We weren't going to be like the other bands that were around, and you either like us or you don't. And it, you know, we like pop music. We're not afraid of saying that. You know, we like rock music. When we rock, it's hard, you know, we rock out. And but when we, you know, when we do something more dreamy or electronic, you know, we kind of go full on into that world, and it ends up sounding like us, because there's a kind of honesty to what we're doing. There's a kind of essence of Maximo Park that somehow filters out, and you know, whatever kind of song that we've made, it has our own sensibility in it. And I think life moves on really fast, and to me it seems very, very close, as I say, those days, and it feels like life will be over sooner than we know. And my daughter growing up, everybody says it, but you know, they grow up fast, and you know, try and enjoy it while, you know, each different period of life, because they you know, they move on to the next one. And it's true, you know, and I try not to be too sad about that. I mean, there's a song on the new record called Versions of You, which is kind of about being away from someone, and looking at pictures on your phone and videos and trying to be close to them, or close to that moment that happened a few years ago that you thought was worth preserving on your phone for posterity. And I found myself only being able to, in my case, remember my daughter as she is right now. You know, I was looking at them and couldn't really understand why I wasn't, you know, in that moment. And it just goes to show, you know, you have to live in the moment. I think it's a very positive thing, but in some moments it's kind of sad, because if you cherished a moment, you want that feeling to last. And I suppose the songs that we write are my way of commemorating small moments in my own life. And it's kind of the way that I feel confident writing. You know, the people write in different ways. Some people are more detached. Some people are more overtly political. And you know, we've dipped into different ways of writing. The last album, Risk to Exist, was a more of political kind of statements, married up with hopefully danceable, funky, soulful music. But once we'd done that, we kind of, you know, we felt like, you know, let's move on to something else with this record. But yet, you know, all of those different things are sort of ingrained into the music that we make. All the things that we've done will somehow pop out at various moments and rise to the surface in our songs, or in an album, or even in a specific song. The middle eight might make you think of one of our other songs, and we don't want to deny that, even though we want to evolve and move on and do different things. And I think that's one of the things that's helped bring people with us from that initial starting point. And we know we still have people buying our records and still coming to our concerts, you know, this, whatever it is, 16 years later. And I think if you invest yourself, you know, a lot of yourself in the music that you make, then it will have that kind of resonance in an ideal world.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Yeah, you've always been a really interesting band for me, because when you came out, you were kind of lumped in with that sort of new wave post-punk revival. And sonically, perhaps, there was definitely elements of that with Wire and Buzzcocks and bands like that. I think you could sort of tell the influence a bit was there. But you guys always had something different to a lot of your contemporaries, in that there was real heart and substance and depth and soul and honesty, all these things which you're alluding to there. They were always there from day one. And I think, you know, pop music, you mentioned as well, that's an interesting way of looking at it, because for me, I look at pop music like the Kinks' Waterloo Sunset, one of the greatest pop songs ever made, and such a simple story of day-to-day life. Like you were saying earlier on, the mundane might not perhaps be obvious material for a pop song, but actually, if you're a good songwriter, you're a good storyteller, you can distill day-to-day life in the most beautiful and evocative, timeless little 3-minute, you know, cinematic epics. And that's obviously something, as a songwriter, you know personally, and as a group, you guys have always come at it from that approach. I think, would that be safe to say, with various musical progressions along the way?
Absolutely. You know, we believe in the power of the song, and we kind of serve the song and try not to have anything extraneous within the song. You know, everything in that sense, they're kind of precision tooled. You know, they're not in a cold way, they're just, it's part of a craft, you know, we're artisans, you know, like in the parlance of our time, you know, everybody's reclaimed that word for this kind of authenticity. But I think it's, you know, there's an element of truth in it, you know, that this labor that we put into it and this thought, as well as the kind of visceral things and the kind of passion that we put into it, there's a thoughtfulness and a reflective quality to our music, even the most punky of songs. And I think that, you know, that you mentioned post-punk music, and I think, yes, a lot of people were trying to recreate the sound of post-punk music. But it's,
yeah,
that's
the key, isn't it? A lot of them were recreating the sound, but they didn't have the same lyrical depth as bands like Magazine. You know, they were copying the Sonics, but the stories, the existential subject matter wasn't perhaps, you know, explored to the same level as you guys were doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not for me to say, but I do believe our intention was to use something like a post-punk ethos, which is, right, you've got your three chords and the truth, and that anger is an energy, but what do you do with it after that? And, yeah, you know, we were trying to find solutions to that. And, you know, you have more electronic stuff on our first record, like I Want You to Stay, Limassol, Acrobat, but you also have this kind of bubblegum pop thing that's going on, you know, almost 50s rock and roll, like Buddy Holly was kind of influencing me when I wrote The Night I Lost My Head off that record, for example. And then you listen to Baby Sleep off the new record, and, you know, Dunk's got this really cool guitar riff, but there's also this you know, beautiful melody on the top, this kind of catchiness. And in many ways that makes us an outlier and an odd band out, really, because we're not afraid of those things. And I love catchy melodies. You know, it's kind of power pop more than anything else. It's something that you know, whether it's Big Star or the Go-Betweens, yeah, yeah, or Felt or something like that, you know, where we are using kind of traditional elements, you know, bass, drums, guitars and keyboards and vocals, but we're trying to do something with it that you might not have heard before, whether it's in the arrangement, whether it's a lyrical idea or a turn of phrase that you might not have heard in a song. I mean, you know, on our first album, there's a song called Now I'm All Over the Shop. And it was interesting to me to kind of get these more colloquial phrases into songs. And again, you know, there were certainly other people at the time in our wake who were doing similar things. So again, it's not a surprise that you know, people lumped us in with some of those other bands. But yeah, I feel like, you know, nobody sang like me. Nobody played the guitar like Dunk, nobody played the drums like Tom, nobody played the keys like Lucas, and nobody played the bass like Archers. And the combination of those five individual personalities is Maximo Park. And it's not, you know, everybody has a voice in our band, which is not always the case. Again, in bands, you know, there's somebody leading it, or there's a songwriting duo. And sure enough, myself and Dunk wrote and continue to write most of the songs, but the arrangements were a real mix of our quite diverse personalities and influences. And that's kind of set the template, even though there's just me and Dunk and Tom left from the original band now, because Lucas emigrated after the last album and has kind of started a family in Australia. We had the time of reflection after that. And we realized that whatever we came up with would still sound like Maximo Park, because it's got my guitar, my voice, and, you know, Dunk's guitar, and now Dunk's playing a bit of keyboards, and that kind of melodic sensibility is there. And I think, you know, you talk about Ray Davis and the Kinks, and, you know, there's a real melodic sensibility that is really Kinksy and Ray Davies, and you can't quite put your finger on it. And I'm sure some musicologists probably could, and they could do the same with, you know, our chord progressions and what keys we write in and what keys favor my voice or whatever. And you know, you can boil it down to those things, but I enjoy that kind of mystery to it. You know, I'm not a trained musician. I have no idea what I'm doing when I start out with the songs. You know, I'd never sung before being in Maximo Park. You know, I didn't know how to do it. So I was just kind of making it up in my early 20s, just trying to figure out what kind of a singer I wanted to be and what kind of a band we should be with the rest of the guys. And yeah, I feel like whatever it is we do, whether you like it or not, it, you know, it sounds like us, and we've made it with the best intentions, you know, to make, you know, to make amazing music. You know, we're ordinary people, and but we want to make music that's incredible and that stands the test of time. And, you know, anybody could get into it in theory. And that to me is pop music. It's something that transcends its genre. Whether it's, I don't know, Sitting on the Dock of the Bay or, you know, Anarchy in the UK, it's, or Summertime by the Fresh Prince or whatever, you know, it's like, it could be anything. It has this kind of, this hooky quality, this melodic quality. And, you know, I like a lot of different type of music, and I might listen to something that's, you know, I don't know, ambient or droney on an evening. But, you know, when a really great song comes on the radio, I put everything down and listen. And I mean, that's kind of reflected in our new song, All of Me. It says, I turn the radio on to find someone who tells me what I need to hear. And I'm looking for that. You know, you might have to wait a couple of songs on whatever station you're listening to, or you might skip from station to station to find that thing. But it's, you know, I still have that pop idealism that makes me energetic and want to write more songs like that, and to find that sort of elusive, you know, gold in the hills.
Yeah, how can we capture it and bottle it for all time in a perfect 3.5 minute little pop song? So what, you know, with Warp Records, so you did, was it 3 albums you did with them?
We did, yes.
I mean, on paper, that must have seemed to outsiders perhaps at the time like a strange choice, but obviously it was a great relationship because it lasted. Do you reckon signing with them kind of scored you some kudos points in the industry and gave you a bit of cred? And what was that relationship like with those guys? Because at that time, you were probably definitely one of the first, right, more commercial mainstream acts. At that point, it was all Boards of Canada and, you know, more avant-garde. How did that come about?
Well, I mean, they saw our first 7-inch, which a friend of ours funded. We made a red 7-inch of Graffiti and Going Missing that was recorded in Duncan Tom's house. On their landing, my vocals were done in a mound of coats so that we didn't have any reverb on it.
Like at a party.
Exactly. I was just underneath a pile trying to sing. And, you know, for whatever reason, it had this kind of this appeal to Warp and to Steve Beckett, who ran Warp. And we felt a kind of kindred spirit, you know, and the people who worked there were, again, on our wavelength, even if, you know, it might be even just be James Burton in the art department, or it could be the people in the warehouse who are sort of sifting through all of the records. You know, they employed interesting people with something to say, and you could extend that to all of the artists. And I think they were definitely branching out. There was Gravenhurst, who had just released his first record when we signed with Warp, Flashlight Seasons, and they had Broadcast and started signing a few extra bands like Chick Chick Chick, who were definitely moving away from that electronica and IDM sound that they were known for. And I think it definitely did make people sit up and notice, even if they looked at it and said, God, what are they doing? You know, at least it kind of ruffled a few feathers. But I think,
I'll bet, yeah.
You know, a lot of people also were exposed to our music who wouldn't have listened to it, and it marked us out as an unusual band in some way. And I think that can only help, especially with the kind of music that we were making, that was this unusual idiosyncratic pop music. You know, that connection made a lot of sense to us, and we were big fans of everybody on the label. You know, you couldn't ask for a better label to be on. You know, there's sort of 2 or 3 independent labels that are kind of up there with Warp, but, you know, to even be on one of those is fantastic. But to be on Warp and be part of this rich lineage of people like Ortega and Aphex Twin and, you know, oddballs like Vincent Gallo, you know, it was...
Well, I was going to ask you, Paul, so on the Warp 20 compilation, you covered When. Vincent Gallo, for me, is one of the most fascinating human beings in the world. He's obviously got some incredibly bizarre and questionable opinions, but I mean, Buffalo 66 alone, just his performance, obviously he directed and wrote it and kind of, I think maybe edited it as well, did he? He seemed to do everything. But what an interest, for those a time when he was, for me, just one of the most interesting, captivating on-screen performers, but then just artists as well. And you, have you ever seen the movie he's in, Arizona Dream, with Johnny Depp?
No, I haven't seen that one, actually.
Oh, mate, you have to see that. That is him at his, like, peak 90s weirdest best. But, I mean, what made you pick that song? Just because it was such a curveball?
It was, I mean, we like the song, for a start. You know, I think it's a beautiful song. I love his vocal on that. And we wanted, we like to do the thing that is not necessarily expected of us, for a start. And, yeah, I mean, when I was in my instrumental band, after art college with my friends Rachel and Laura, we used to have Buffalo 66 in the background while we were playing, and we used to project that, actually.
Amazing. Proper Velvet Underground style.
Yeah, and you know, we weren't singing, so we thought let's put something else on the screen. And we were all fans of that music, of that film and the soundtrack, actually.
Did he do the music to that film as well?
He did. He did the music, and there's like a few Yes songs, and there's like Moonchild on there, King Crimson. And we had a song called Christina Ricci, which was influenced by the movie. And so we would play, when we played that, we would put the bowling alley scene where she dances and the lights come down on the screen behind us, and then move on to some other Super 8 stuff that we'd filmed ourselves of cranes at Wall's End, which then ended up influencing Maxine Wall Park's I Want You to Stay, where it says where cranes collect the sky. So it was all kind of, you know, intertwined, you know, being influenced by things, letting things rub off on you. And I mean, looking back,
Did you ever meet him?
No, I didn't. I'm not sure I'd want to.
Fair enough.
The thought scares me a little bit because, Phil Canning, who was the international press guy at Warp at the time, you know, he had a few interesting tales about Vincent Gallo.
I'll bet.
I mean, wherever the influences come from, we'll always try and have a nod to them along the way.
I don't want to ask you, I want to tell you a little story, and I'm sure you'll appreciate this. So many, many years ago, I was dating a girl called Joanne Billingham, her name was, and she taught me to look at your song, Apply Some Pressure, in a different way, because I'd just sort of always taken it as just this really catchy, infectious, great pop song, but I'd never really delved behind the meaning of the lyrics or anything. And obviously, you know, you might have a different interpretation. I'm sure you will. It's your song. But for Jo, she said there was a period in her life where she did lose everything. You know, she'd come out of a really, I think, intense breakup, and, you know, her whole life as she knew it had disappeared. And she said that song was like this anthem for her of strength and defiance and, you know, holding on and carrying on. And obviously there's that, you know, amazingly potent and powerful lyric in it, the way you sing it as well. What happens when you lose everything? You just start again, you start all over again. And I've been thinking a lot more just about that song and that mindset in this, you know, pandemic time, because I, like many people, you know, I'm a DJ by trade. That's where I make most of my money. So, you know, I've lost all my work through this, and I had to leave London and move back home with my folks and all this sort of stuff and kind of recalibrate life, and just sort of been looking at the world like, oh God, I've lost everything. But then there's almost a freedom and a liberation that comes with that. And it really is, if you want it to be, a case of just as simple as, well, let's just start afresh from scratch and build it up again. And it really, I mean, this story from Joe's interpretation of the song is from many, many years ago, but I guess it's only really been for me in this year that I've had that connection with it. And I'd love to hear about your experience and the inspiration behind that song in particular.
Well, for me, it was,
you don't mind divulging
stuff. For me, it was relationship driven, and in many ways, it's kind of advice to myself. And, you know, when things go wrong or things don't work out how you want them to, especially when you feel intensely about somebody, or you have these kind of dreams that you project. And as the lyric says, you change the way I think about myself. You know, somebody who has, you know, shifted your thinking on life, and things don't work out, you have to find a way beyond that. You know, you can't live like that. And I suppose that, you know, there are parts of the song that kind of celebrate that relationship and the way that we can get can move on from that and celebrate it again. You know, the song is a sort of celebration, a commemoration. And yet at the end, it has this more all-encompassing phrase that, it, you know, in that kind of middle to end section where it's, you know, the what happens when you lose everything part comes in. And yeah, lots of people have approached me over the years and have spoken about very difficult times in their lives and mentioned that song being the thing that got them through. And, you know, to me, it just blows my mind that people have had that reaction to the music that we've made and to the lyrics that I've written. Because obviously, I, you know, they're very personal to me initially. And I always try and make sure that they've got some sort of universal meaning within all of that. You know, I don't want them to be diary entries. You know, I've always said that. I think because there is a confessional and cathartic element to them, it could easily tip over into that territory. And maybe sometimes, you know, for some people, it probably does. But to me, it's the way that I write, and that line is me sort of saying it to myself every night when I sing it. Even now, you know, I still feel, you know, overwhelmed by the song to some extent.
That's amazing. I was going to ask you that because it's obviously such a popular song. You've obviously sung it way more than 1,000 at this stage, probably thousands of times. And I was intrigued to know, do you still get invested in it and inhabit those words in the same way as you did when you wrote it? And the answer you're saying there is obviously, yeah.
Yeah, I do. And I don't like practicing it. I don't like practice it, A, because it's really high pitched, but yeah. B, because, you know, I have sang it so many times, but as soon as I'm in a room with an audience, you know, it transforms, it completely changes meaning. And I kind of save myself, you know, when I'm practicing, I don't want to get into it too much. You know, I want to make sure that I know the songs inside out so that when it comes to performances, I can focus on the performance. I can focus on, you know, getting the correct emotions for the way I'm singing. And yeah, I even in the practice room, sometimes when it gets to that final bit, it's just whatever it is, you know, again, the combination in a song of the melody, the words, the music behind it, all of those different things somehow combine and create, you know, the tingle down the spine and this moment that is hard to explain. And, you know, so I often have moments like that when we're practicing where I'll just kind of just get so into it. And when we first practiced and we hadn't even played in front of people, that was kind of how I was, you know, to some extent. You know, I wasn't kind of jumping and hitting my head on the ceiling or anything, but I was, you know, getting into it. And I'd never performed before. I'd never sang before on that level. You know, I'd played guitar and, you know, done some high kicks so that we knew which section of this instrumental song was the next, you know, and move on to the next bit. And it all, you know, you build up all of these different things over the years, but it comes, yeah, it does come down to very simple things, really, a melody, a band playing, and a lyric that means something to you and to other people. And even if I was bored of it, which I'm not, when I see people and how much they love that song in the front row, and
that's got to be a powerful thing.
Yeah, people at the back with their arms in the air, you know, the people who've just been playing it cool and drinking the pints because, you know, we've all got different gig personalities, and just that moment when you play not just that song but a few, you know, quite a few of the other ones, where it's not just the people at the front going mad, where the whole room is just, you know, in this moment, you know, I can't help but be moved by that. I can't help but throw myself even more into the songs, which again, people can see that when we play live. I've never given less than 100%, and you know, I still remember going to the supermarket and picking up a music magazine, and somebody had said, you know, it was pretty good or whatever. Paul Smith seemed to be phoning in his performance, and it made me want to, like, you know, maybe want to do bad things. You know, it made me feel quite violent.
Well, do you know what? I come from that world to some extent, but I hate the term journalist. Like, if people say, oh, my friend Matt is a journalist, I go, whoa, don't call me that. And, many ways I am, because I like to encapsulate stories and share experiences, but I hate critics so much. And this isn't you saying this, I'll just say it for you. The idea of, like, scathingly writing about, you know, either a record, a piece of art, or a live show performance that somebody has poured their heart and soul into, you just sit there and write it off with a few words, especially now in the age when you can just, you know, if you read a bad review, that's not going to stop anybody going to a show or listening to the record, I think. I think it's such a redundant profession. And so I can fully feel your pain because, you know, even if I put up a podcast episode and it gets like a bad review on iTunes, I'm like, what? But it was free. You didn't have to listen to it. What's wrong with you?
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. I don't mind necessarily that critics are out there, you know, sharpening their pencils and, you know, doing what they need to do. And, you know, there needs to be some sort of critical opinion about things. Otherwise, you know, it's just this homogenous gloop. But I think when it becomes more personal and when it's kind of intimating something that clearly isn't true, I think you could probably criticize the fact that I put too much into my performances, and I would go along with that and I'd say, okay, you either like it or you don't. But to say something like that, it's one of those things that kind of sticks in your mind, because you think that's just not what it's all about. You know, for me, it is about that passion and the connection with what you're doing. And you know, it's just the nature of the band. I can't, you know, we're not the Velvet Underground, you know, we're not the Clash, you know, we are only our own selves, and the way that we are comes across in the songs, for better or for worse. You know, you have to stay true to what you believe in and how you want to express yourself.
Yeah, and I think as well, the flip side to that is if you do read something disparaging about yourself, that fuels you then with every performance, hopefully going forward, if you're self-aware enough to go, well, I'm not going to let them have me like that again. So I'm out here to prove that I mean this 110%. And a tiny little bit of that driving you can actually be quite healthy, I think, is that idea of anybody could be watching tonight and it doesn't matter who they're, you know, who they are. Let's just go out there and give everybody the best performance that I can.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And at least I know I've done my job.
Absolutely.
Listen, Paul, I could talk to you all day, but I feel like I should let you go at this stage because you've got many things to do, I'm sure. But on a personal level, I just wanted to say that was one of the best conversations I've ever had doing this show, and I've done over 200 at this stage. What a thoroughly engaging and smart and sweet and cool guy you are. So thanks so much for giving up your time and just being so, you know, generous and thoughtful and great with, well, I don't even want to say your answers because it felt like we were more just chatting away. But yeah, thanks for just fucking being a great, great guest.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks for having me.
When you get some shows in the diary, which will hopefully be not too far away, now things are sort of beginning to potentially open up for the summer and autumn and beyond, I'd love to come down to a show and see you guys do your thing.
Absolutely.
Well, I'd love to go to many shows, but I definitely am going to put Maximo Park near the top of that list.
Please do. You know, we've still got in the back of our mind the hopes that the dates that we've got are going to happen later in the year, but everything's so up and down and uncertain. We'll keep our fingers crossed.
Amazing. Well, listen, mate, all the best. Congratulations on everything. And thanks again for coming on the show and entertaining me. It's been great, man.
No worries. Take care and have a good evening.
I like to wait to see how things turn out. If you apply some pressure, I like to wait and see how things turn out.